Our next case for argument is 23-1438, Provisor Technologies v. Weber. Mr. Milliken, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. There are three issues on appeal: non-infringement, willfulness, and damages. I think the legal error in the admission of the damages testimony is starkly evident from the briefing. If the panel has questions about that issue, I'm certainly happy to address them, but otherwise I'll focus my time today on infringement and willfulness. Before I jump into the issues that were briefed, I will quickly address Provisor's 28J response from yesterday. The parties are in agreement that this Court's ruling in the IPR appeal has obviated our appellate non-infringement argument on the 436 and 812 patents.
So you accept the liability judgment, the infringement judgment on those two patents?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, and let me explain why. So the other effect of that IPR appeal ruling is to put those patents' validity back in play. We're on remand before the board now. And also potentially to create claim construction issues. We don't know how the board is going to decide it, but the landscape with respect to those patents is uncertain now. And so, for example, if the patents were ultimately adjudged invalid while this case is still pending, then Provisor's infringement claims would be moot under Fresenius. There would be no cause of action left.
Yes, but I understood your 28J letter to moot those non-infringement arguments with regard to the two of the three patents. Is that not correct?
The non-infringement argument that we pressed on appeal, yes, Your Honor. Okay. I acknowledge that is no longer available to us.
Okay, so there was an infringement finding. You appealed non-infringement. You are now waiving that appeal of non-infringement, correct?
We're waiving the appeal of non-infringement on the bases that were available to us at the time of the district court decision. My point is that if, for example, the PTAB finds these claims unpatentable on remand, then we would have a new argument that we're entitled to relief from judgment under Fresenius if this case is still pending, for example, on damages. And so I would submit that
that's all you're trying to preserve.
There is some chance that there could be a claim construction that the board would issue with respect to a couple dependent claims that might or might not open up a new non-infringement position for us. I think that's pretty speculative at this point. But because of the uncertainty, what I'd submit to the court is that the most reasonable path forward is to, and given that we're already requesting vacater of the damages portion of the judgment, simply vacate the judgment of the 436 and 812 patents.
Why won't we vacate that? There was a judgment of infringement, and you have withdrawn your appeal as to that judgment of infringement with regard to infringement. Why would we then vacate that judgment of infringement? That makes no sense.
Because there is precedent for appellate courts to vacate judgments when the factual circumstances underlying the judgments have changed. And that's what's happened here, because we now have a validity challenge to that patent that previously had been decided against us and now is live again in front of the PTAB. I am not disputing that the court has the power to affirm the judgment. I acknowledge that the argument we preserved on appeal is foreclosed. I am simply saying that the court has the discretion to vacate and instruct the district court to assess the impact of the PTAB's ultimate decision, if any,
on the proceedings. To be clear, you filed a 28J letter after this all took place. Do you mention anywhere in this 28J letter that you think the proper course of action is for us to vacate the court's infringement determination? Because I don't see it.
No, Your Honor.
So how did you give them an opportunity to either respond or come prepared to argument to respond to this brand new resolution that you're making for the first time?
Your Honor, I am responding to their suggestion in their 28J letter that they filed yesterday, 2 months after ours, that the proper course is to affirm. In my view, at the time we filed our original 28J letter, that was right after the mandate issued in the IPR appeal, it was before the remand proceeding started, it was before argument in this case had been calendared, I think suggesting any particular disposition would have been premature. I am now responding to the suggestion from the other side in their own letter that affirmance is the proper course. If there are no other questions on that, I'll move on to what was briefed. I'll start with non-infringement of the 936 patent. It is undisputed that the smart loader, as sold to customers, is configured to work in the opposite way to what Claim 14 of the 936 patent requires. The claim requires that a conveyor advance while it's filling pockets with food. In the accused smart loader, the conveyor retracts and lets the food fall down into pockets that are below. Now, the 936 patent did have some claims that covered a retract-to-fill configuration. Those claims were found invalid by the PTAB, and that was affirmed by this court. So the only ones left are the ones that require advancing to fill, and that's the reason they're the only ones left, because the advance-to-fill configuration was not disclosed in the prior art. Now, Provisor doesn't dispute that the smart loader is a retract-to-fill machine, just like the prior art distinguished in the IPR. It doesn't dispute that no Weber customer has ever used the smart loader to advance to fill, and there's not even any dispute that Weber customers can't use the smart loader to advance to fill because the parameters that one could allegedly manipulate in order to make it advance to fill are not available to the users. You have to be a Weber personnel in order to get into that interface.
But there is testimony from your adversary's expert about actually getting it to work that way.
There is testimony from the expert about getting it to advance. He did not go so far as to say that he actually made it advance and then fill pockets with food while it was advancing. And you don't have to take my word for that. Provisor told the district court in post-trial briefing, this is a quote, Dr. Vorse, quote, was unable to configure the smart loader to advance to fill because of timing. That's at appendix 43386. And so it was common ground below that while he was able to adjust some parameters and make the machine advance, he was never able to make it do what the claim actually requires, is advance and then while it's advancing, drop the food into the pockets. And that is legally insufficient to show infringement because it's not enough for Provisor to show that the machine could be modified to infringe. It's got to show that the machine actually does infringe when operated in the ordinary course, and at the very minimum.
Although I think this is a quote. If you take a look at 41398, do you rely on the programmabilities of the smart loader to show that it's configured to fill the the pockets as claimed? Yes, I mean, I relied on it, and we were able to actually show it working. And I know you're drawing a distinction between advancing and advancing to fill. But what would you make of this statement?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I read that statement to say only that he was able to make it advance. And he admitted on cross-examination that he wasn't actually able to use it to show food product being deposited. And then we have the further information that the Provisor said to the district court in post-trial briefing, he wasn't able to configure it to advance to fill, and told the jury in closing argument that Weber, quote, wouldn't let Dr. Vorst reprogram the smart loader to advance to fill. And so, again, I think it was common ground below that while he was able to configure the machine in some pretty vague, unidentified way, he was never able to actually make it do what the claim requires, which is move forward.
I'm not sure it was a vague or unidentified way. His demonstrative exhibits show him putting certain numbers in certain parameter boxes, the most important ones being the front and the rear, the starting, and he sort of reversed them, the numbers, and that would reverse the direction. Are you making a legal argument that in light of the fact that the screens with those parameters were not available to a user, that would not come within our small number of cases about configuring embracing situations where all the user has to do is, turn a switch on or the equivalent of turning a switch on, because here the user can't do that.
I think that under this court's cases on reasonable capability of apparatus claims, that's not legally sufficient. Under IMBT, which we cited at page 47 of the blue brief, Telemac is another example.
And that ground would, if it were correct, can take as an assumption that there's some uncertainty about what Dr. Forst ended up actually doing, whether the salami was dropping or not.
It can, Your Honor. I think this is an easier case than that because I read the record to disclose that he was not able to make it drop the salami into the pockets.
But he says over and over again he could have done so if he had just been given a little more time. And this is a substantial evidence question, jury verdict. He says over and over and over again that he would be capable of programming this. It has all the parameters. He just have to put the right numbers in. And he says, I just didn't have enough time. Basically, they kicked me out. And so, I mean, under a substantial evidence theory, how do we find fault with that?
We don't
go the route Judge Toronto just proposed.
So two responses to that. The first is Judge Toronto's theory, which I agree with, which is that capability is reasonable capability, and if the users can't even do the thing that you're saying is I apologize. No. The second reason is because at a bare minimum, and this is extremely clear from INVT, you've got to show that the thing actually was put in the infringing configuration and actually did what's required by the claim once. And that's what we're saying Dr. Vorst didn't do because he said he didn't have time to do it.
I have a question about that. In terms of that, if this is a very important issue, how was it teed up before the district court? How were there discovery issues remaining as to this, that there were time issues still?
So in terms of how it was teed up, we moved for summary judgment of non-infringement of this patent on
But was there any inquiry to the judge as to the process of examining this machine?
No, there were inspections that took place pre-trial. Provisor never raised any complaint or dispute about those inspections. The first time that we heard about this alleged inability to have enough time to do the inspection that he needed was at trial and in front of the jury. And we think that was an improper sort of putting the discovery process in front of the jury, especially since this issue had never even been previewed before. But the point is, Provisor was...
So you're saying there was no dispute pre-trial as to the amount of time to look at the machine or how to perform an inspection and what would be permitted?
That is correct, Your Honor. There's nothing, I'm not aware of anything, and there is nothing in the record supporting that there was any kind of dispute about this beforehand.
I mean, despite the blizzard... You also, this case had lots of fun in it.
And it was his birthday.
Yes, right, exactly. Despite the blizzard and the fact that it was his birthday, you did in fact ask, did you ever ask to come back and see it a second time? And he said no, right?
Correct. Yes. Which supports the point I'm making, which is that this issue hadn't been raised.
That was what we call a softball.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Why don't you touch on willfulness quick?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor. So Provisor presented two principal categories of willfulness evidence. The first was the testimony of its patent lawyer expert, Mr. White. Mr. White said that Weber should have sought a landscape search, a background search, a freedom to operate opinion, or had someone analyze the non-infringement or invalidity of these patents. That violated 35 U.S.C. Section 298, which says, in no uncertain terms, that you cannot rely on the lack of an opinion of counsel to show willful infringement. And you cannot avoid Section 298 by simply substituting the word third party for lawyer. That cannot be the law. It would render the statute.
If you take out White's testimony, let's assume, because we're... running out of time. Let's assume there was a 298 violation. At a minimum, there would have to be setting aside of the willfulness determination. Sure. You're asking for JMAL of no willfulness, so it must be that without the improper part of White's testimony, and I don't know whether you think all of his testimony was improper or whether only some of it, that there wouldn't be enough for a reasonable finding of willfulness.
Correct. I do think all of it was improper. I want to be clear first about the relief we're seeking. We're seeking at a minimum to vacate the willfulness verdict and send it back for a new trial with no 298 violation. But we don't think if you take out the 298 violation that there was substantial evidence at all for the willfulness finding. And if the court agrees, then the proper remedy would be reversal. So as to what is left, the remainder of Mr. White's testimony was basically just a narrative of some factual evidence that Provisor thought was helpful to it. It walked through this patent matrix where some of Weber's employees had rated the asserted patents with a 3. He talked about interrogatory responses and the fact that Weber's admitted date of knowledge
had
moved early.
Could be excluded under 298, right? The patent.
I agree. This is a separate issue from 298. My point is, if you take out 298,
that's all the fluff.
All we have left is fluff, not the proper subject of expert testimony.
Okay, why don't we save a little time for rebuttal?
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martin, please proceed.
So, good morning. My name is Craig Martin. I represent Provisor on the appeal. We would ask that the appellate court affirm the district court's judgment in all respects. With regard to the arguments, I think why don't I focus first on the willfulness, the issue that we just picked up on, and then I'll go to the substantial evidence issue. With regard to willfulness, it's the substantial evidence standard. There was overwhelming evidence with regard to the willfulness case in this regard. The evidence clearly showed that Weber knew about the patents, that many of their senior executives, including their CEO, had rated the patents, had looked at them, had rated them for relevance. We don't really know if that's true or not.
For this 3 rating to be evidence of what willfulness requires, you would actually need some evidence that the meaning of that 3 was, oh my goodness, we are in trouble. We think we're doing that.
Yeah, they testify.
And I don't remember what that evidence is.
Yeah, their testimony, this particular document that we're talking about, came up late after discovery was produced. Their testimony with regard to their witnesses had been that they had never reviewed the patents consistently. I mean, about a half a dozen witnesses had testified they had never reviewed them. They had given different explanations for what that review actually meant, and they were subject to what I would call rigorous cross-examination at trial. So we actually, in terms of credibility contest with regard to what this really meant, there was a live credibility contest.
Wasn't there also an issue of a query regarding this type of document, and then your adversary had to actually create the document because it was not one in existence? I believe at least that might be their argument. And as a result, time went by, the case evolved, and then the witnesses were asked these questions about whether they knew about these patents and their ratings, 1, 2, 3. They initially said they didn't know, but then ultimately realized, oh, they had talked about it. Is that at all an assessment that you're familiar with?
It's a charitable read. In terms of I'm familiar with the assessment, I don't think it's borne out by the facts.
Was the document, though, created for purposes of litigation?
No, the document was a document that existed in an ESI database.
Did your adversary assert that it was created for purposes of litigation?
No. No.
Okay. They
maintained that it was a document that was maintained by a third party as opposed to them, who was beyond their control. But it was actually their agent called the Patent Office, I think it was called. And so, you know, that argument, you know, from a district court perspective or from a discovery perspective, the notion that it was frankly beyond their control was nonsense. It was always within their control. They did contend that it was privileged, and they lost that contention.
Okay, now, but as to the substance of it, what is the significance for purposes of this case of giving it a rating and then being aware of these other patents?
Yeah, so the significance of it, Let me tell you, there's two types of awareness that come up, right? One is that document and the fact that there are witnesses who, we said, lied about it in their depositions, actually knew about it, right? So they lied about it, is what we contended in front of the jury. Their U.S. CEO, who verified...
Did they lie about it, or did they say they had no recollection of it?
There were different responses from different of these six or seven witnesses, and some were dead-on contradictions. And
what was the worst scenario that you have?
Don't remember, but it was good.
So don't remember doesn't actually always signal something terrible.
It was good. In terms of, but they also had their U.S. CEO who had verified multiple interrogatories about whether they knew about our patents and when they knew about those patents. And those interrogatory responses changed multiple times, six, seven times.
Yeah, but all of this goes to knowledge of the patent.
Right.
So that's not sufficient for willfulness. So I don't really see them arguing on appeal that there's no substantial evidence for willfulness because we didn't have knowledge of the patent. I don't see that to be the issue on appeal. I understand the issue to be on appeal is there isn't evidence to substantiate that we understood we infringed this patent, that our particular product, the smart something or other, what's it called?
Smart loader.
The smart loader infringes these particular patents. I understand that to be their argument. Am I mistaken? Do you understand them to be arguing on appeal that we didn't even know about the patents and that's why we can't be found?
Look, I understand that the contention is essentially the empty set with regard to direct testimony of state of mind. So direct testimony of state of mind.
I don't understand anything you just said. How about let me ask a question? You could say yes or no.
Sure.
Do you understand their argument on appeal to be we didn't know about the fact that this patent existed?
No, I don't understand that to be their
argument. So isn't their argument on appeal that we didn't know that our smart loader infringed this patent?
I think that must be their argument on appeal, that they didn't intend, that they were not willful. But if you look at the factors and you look at the testimony with regard to the trial, there's one expert witness, John White, who testifies about the custom and practice with regard to once you have knowledge with respect to a patent, what are the steps that you go through to assure that you don't go...
But that's exactly the 298 problem. You can't put an expert on the stand that faults them for not getting an opinion.
No, that's not what his testimony was about. His testimony was about, in a meticulous way, going through the steps that industry competitors go through with respect to what they do to investigate, and no mention of legal opinion or anything else, and no mention of what their state of mind was. So he goes through the steps that you have to go through in terms of what the investigation should be to avoid infringement. And there was no testimony whatsoever that they had ever formed a good faith belief. So if you look straight down the standards
this is your burden, right, on establishing willfulness. So whether or not Mr. White uttered the words, you're urging that the failure to do all of that stuff is a basis for an inference that they, under the willfulness standard, knew or it should have been obvious that they were infringing.
Well, if you look at the factors in instruction 23, which is at appendix 43, the first is whether they acted consistently with the standards of behavior in the industry, and the answer from Mr. White was no. After going through all of those factors, another one is.
And you think that those factors can apply even when the investigations that were not done are routinely done by lawyers?
They're not routinely done by lawyers.
Why would that not be a violation of 298, which was enacted after the enumeration of those factors?
That's not what the evidence was. The evidence was a clear explanation by Mr. White, also by the provisor U.S. CEO, as to the steps that people go through to avoid infringement. There was no mention by either one of them saying that there was no lawyer involved in getting an opinion. There was, with regard to Weber actually designed around the smart loader. You know, part of the evidence in the case is Weber had changed its source code in response to the related European patent with respect to the smart loader or the configurable loader. And that was after all of the US sales. In fact, their expert witness, when he testified that he examined the source code, but he didn't know what source code he examined. He, in terms of their witnesses, as I said, had dissembled and we think not told the truth about their knowledge of the patents or what they had done. So they
and you think the dissembling as to one thing is a legitimate ground for inferring falsity as to another, namely the knowledge of infringement as opposed to the knowledge of the patents.
I don't think
is an unfounded contention.
I think you can reasonably infer that their conduct with regard to whether they knew about the patents and what they did in response to it was, infected the willfulness finding. They had no evidence with regard to whether they reasonably believed the patents were valid or invalid. They had no evidence.
Okay, I think we better move you on to infringement because we're running out of time, and I don't want you to not have a chance to address infringement.
Okay. So with respect to infringement, this is the Vorst issue, so I'll try to go through it as quickly as I can. With regard to Dr. Vorst, just background, right? He's a true expert. He's got
We don't need any of that. How about this? What does configurable mean? So under our case law, if a product is sold that is, if the user is able to then utilize it in an infringing way, sort of out of the box or, readily, I would say, then there's a problem.
Yeah.
How does this scenario fit into that box?
Fits right into the Versat case. In that box, it is configurable.
The only problem, and it's the question that Judge Toronto asked that's really troubling me as well, is that Dr. Vorst said the way that he didn't have a chance to do it, but the way that he would have turned the smart loader into an advanced to fill conveyor belt as opposed to a retractable conveyor belt would be by modifying the parameters. Why don't you turn to page 93782? Those are his four pictures, the photos, okay, the yeah. inspection photos from the smart loader, HMI. This is what he talks about throughout his testimony. It's 93782. Do you see those four pictures?
I think I'm on the same page.
Yeah.
Okay. So those four pictures. So here's the problem. Only one of those four images, and it's undisputed in this record, having read all of it myself, I can tell you, only one of those four pictures, the bottom right one, it says configurable number of loadings, is actually a screen that a user can gain access to when they are utilizing their smart loader. The other three images are hidden and protected, and only a Weber technician or the Weber factory can alter them prior to delivery, or a Weber technician would have to come to your premises to manually change them. But you, the user, can't do that. So that's the testimony of record. So how is this device therefore configurable such that a user could utilize it in an infringing way when to do so, the user can't gain access at all to the parameter screens that would allow it to do that?
Well, Your Honor, I think precisely because Dr. Vorst went and did that at his inspection, and he did it in the position of a user.
No, they gave him access to it. They gave him access to these screens.
The HMI screen is available to the users. To the customers of the product. In terms of some of the screens that I think you're pointing at may be behind and you may need a texter person.
Do you see this screen? Configurable rear and front position.
I do.
Do you see the screen that says configurable products positions?
Yes.
All of the testimony of record is that those screens are not accessible except by a Weber technician or at the Weber factory, which is where you all were, and that a user cannot gain access to them. I can walk you through the testimony if you'd like. There's no contrary testimony.
But the testimony from Dr. Vorst, Your Honor, is that he, using the HMI, was able to change a few parameters.
Those are the screens he said he changed. Those are the screens he said he would have to change in order to convert the Weber retract-to-fill device into an advance-to-fill. So if those are the screens that one, according to your expert, has to be able to modify, and if nobody can get to it without being either at the Weber factory or having a Weber technician do it, then how is that device configurable by a user to infringe?
Your Honor, I can only go back to his precise testimony. He testified repeatedly that he was able to use the HMI interface to change and reconfigure to an advance to fill.
Did he go step by step to acknowledge this? And if you'd like to just, I know we're running out of time, but do you have anything quick you might respond with on that?
Well, look, in terms of his testimony and the cross-examination with regard to him, which they had the full and fair opportunity to cross-examine him, his testimony was, I use the HMI screen to easily configure this in an advance-to-fill mode. And that's what he testifies to. He doesn't, and nobody cross-examines him and says you have to go beyond a wall or you have to have a tech store technician there. There's no cross-examination with regard to Dr. Vorst, and the evidence is essentially unrebutted in the record. So,
you say it's unrebutted in the record, let's turn to page 41894, which is Dr. Valeri's testimony. 41894. He is, you're going to have to just take my word for it because I've tracked it. He's talking about that exact exhibit that Dr. Vorst used with those four screens. So you're just going to have to take my word for that. 41894. Do you have that?
I don't have it, but I know what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, I'll read it to you then. Are all these screens available to West Weber customers? No. And just which one of these four screens is available to the customer? Only the bottom right screen that has the configurable number of loads and some adjustment parameters. That's the only one available to a customer of Weber. What about the other three screens? The other three screens are available to a Weber technician who can then input parameters into those three screens. Dr. Vorst was suggesting these screens showed during his testimony. Yes, I believe Dr. Vorst implied that the parameters in the screen would generate a certain advance to feed and result. So the parameters in these screens, according to Dr. Vorst, would allow the smart... Yes, that's correct. So then he goes through and works through it. But what they say here, and unless I'm mistaken, is, and I think it's actually in the second place too, but this is the one I flagged, but what Dr. Valeri says is that three of those four screens that Dr. Horst said one would need to access and modify aren't accessible to a customer at all.
Yes. So, Your Honor, Dr. Valerity, a very nice man. However, his testimony was totally irrelevant and discredited. Dr. Valerity was their source code expert. Dr. Valerity inspected their source code. He did so. He didn't know this, by the way, at the time. But he did so after they had changed the source code in response to the European patent 427, which was after all of the infringing sales. When we asked and cross-examined Dr. Valerity as to what he was looking at with regard to these issues, he had no idea. So, Your Honor, in terms of the most...
Where is that? My problem is, I see this evidence, and I see no contrary evidence. I see no evidence in this record that these three screens were something that, like, I could pull up on my thermostat, or I could pull up on my phone, or a customer could pull up in their particular location to actually modify the device.
So the evidence with regard to this is Dr. Vorst does an inspection. He testifies as to what he's able to access in his inspection, right?
Where's that testimony? Show me. Exactly.
No, generally in his, he doesn't talk about going beyond screens. He says, I went to the HMI interface. I pushed a few buttons, and he talks about which buttons he pushed. And then he says, I had it advancing in a to fill manner. So he configures it using the HMI interface. And there's no testimony, there's no cross-examination about how he has to go through a special screen or go to somebody at Textor. Dr. Valerdi, who, and I don't have the, I do somewhere, but the Dr. Valerdi testifies, and he says, you cannot do it. You just can't do it. I've looked at the source code.
That doesn't have anything to do with these screens. All I'm asking about is the screen.
But he says you cannot do it. On cross-examination, Dr. Valerdi admits that he doesn't even know what he was looking at. He doesn't know if he was looking at the way this was done with regard to the infringing machines that they had sold prior to the change that they made with regard to the 427 lawsuit. He doesn't know if it's afterward. And he essentially becomes the credibility null set because he adds nothing to the trial. And in fact...
Well, what is the testimony, though, regarding what's available, for example, to an end user? Do you have a specific site that you'd like to reference for that?
There's not a dispute about that at trial. There's no dispute with regard to this issue. In fact, Dr. Vorst's testimony is not rebutted by Dr. Valerdi. And their other expert, Dr. Reinholtz, on cross-examination, begins by saying you cannot do it, and then on cross-examination, he admits that you can do it. And he admits that you can change on cross-examination.
Let's turn to page 41403. That is in volume 2. 41403. Let's go to line 24-ish. I think this is Dr. Horst's testimony. So just like Dr. Valeri, who said these are not available to the customer, do you see here that with regard to these exact same screens, this is the manual PX241, the exact same four screens. Your expert says, starting on line 24, yes, I do. You'll see the configure. So I'm going to set this up for you folks. So we arrived at the plant. We inspected this equipment. The Weber folks were very nice. They were very polite. The only issue I had was when I was trying to inspect this equipment, there were so many lockout screens, I couldn't gain access. I had to really kind of pry. We were able to get it, but it took up a lot of our time. So that was probably the source of frustration for me because I knew it was in the manual, I knew it was... So, I mean, all these lockout screens,
and
so
it was,
the customer couldn't gain access.
No, he did gain access. He says he had to pry. He had to go gain access. He doesn't say that he had to get a Weber technician to give him access. There is no dispute about this that's live at trial. He has access. He says very specifically that he is able to configure to advance to fill. And, you know, I appreciate Dr. Valerdi's testimony, but his testimony, as I said, was the empty set because he didn't know what he was inspecting when he actually inspected it. And, you know, he goes out. Well,
maybe just one more. I asked it before, but I'm not sure if I got an answer. And it was with respect to the actual end user, not a technician, not someone at the plant, but how would this be available to them?
The end user with regard to the customer?
Yes, being able to manipulate this.
They would have the HMI screen that was available, we think, to Dr. Vorst. With regard to Dr. Valerdi, we have no idea what he actually inspected. But I will tell you that there was no argument and there was no contention that this was somehow blocked from Dr. Valerdi, other than the comment that Chief Judge Moore just pointed out about how he was frustrated because he had to get past a couple of screens.
Okay, but thank you, Mr. Martin. We're way out of time. Mr. Milliken, I'll restore your rebuttal time.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll pick up with non-infringement. Chief Judge Moore, you hit the nail on the head. The evidence is uniform that the parameters Dr. Vorst said you would configure to make this machine purportedly advanced to fill are not available to users. They are only available to Weber technicians. In addition to the record sites that you would...
And to Dr. Vorst.
And to Dr. Vorst when he asked Weber
technicians. What do you do with that?
It doesn't matter because in order to have infringement under, for a apparatus capability claim, you've got to show reasonable capability, which means it would infringe without some kind of unforeseen modification in the ordinary course. And Weber's customers don't have access to this. And in addition...
How did Dr. Vorst get access to it, ultimately?
Because Weber's technicians gave him access.
Is that in the record anywhere?
Not quite on the nose, but he says, he makes statements like, Your Honor pointed to one of them, statements like, oh, I really had to pry to get access to these HMI interfaces, and it took a while, but finally they did give me access. That's about as close as it gets.
We should understand the word pry to be something other than fiddle around just him and his fingers on the screen, but rather talk to other people who were there. This is at the Weber facility, right?
That's correct. There's actually another site, Appendix 41259 through 60. This is at the beginning of Dr. Vorst's testimony, and there he's talking kind of broadly about how he had to ask Weber folks permission and get them to allow him to program the machine in certain ways. And in addition to the sites Your Honor pointed out, Appendix 41904, that's Dr. Valerdi, and then Appendix 42133, that's Dr. Reinholtz. That's yet more testimony that these screens were not available to customers.
What was the last one, 41 what?
42133, and that's Dr. Reinholtz. A brief word about Versada, which my friend mentioned. In Versada, the expert actually implemented the infringing functionality without changing the code, and then critically, it was undisputed that customers were going to use the machine in the same way that the expert had. That evidence is completely lacking here. Two quick words on willfulness. The first is, I heard my friend reference a design around of the smart loader. There is no evidence in the record that there was a design around with respect to this patent. The source code change that was referred to several times undisputedly had nothing to do with the machine's ability or lack thereof to advance to fill. And there's an implicit concession of this at page 34 through 35, footnote 5 of Provisor's red brief. Finally, on willfulness, I want to sort of make clear the timeline of the Weber's knowledge of the patents and the patent matrix, because I think it got a little muddled in my friend's argument. As an initial matter, Chief Judge Moore, you're right. No dispute we knew about the patents. The issue is, did we know we were infringing? They ask us in interrogatories, identify your first date of knowledge of the patents. By the time deposition started, we had conceded knowledge of the patents for the entire damages window for all three patents. And then, after that, depositions took place. They asked these witnesses questions about, have you seen this patent before? And the witnesses said, I don't remember. Then there was this discovery fight about whether the patent office matrix was discoverable or not, whether it was privileged. We ultimately lost that, but the district court acknowledged that there was case law going both ways. But the point I want to leave you with, and I see I'm out of time, but if I may finish my thought. The point I want to leave you with is the threes on the patent matrix. The only evidence in the record is that all a three means is that the patent is relevant, and what relevant means is it's in the same general field that Weber operates in. So, like, it's another patent on a slicer, in the case of the 436 or the 812, or it's another patent on a loader, in the case of the 936. There is no evidence in the record that a three indicates any knowledge of infringement. And so we'd ask for the judgment of willfulness of all three patents to be reversed, and for the reasons in our briefing and that I stated earlier, the damages judgment be vacated and infringement on the 936 be reversed.
I thank both counsels.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Taken under submission.